Yes, good morning, members of the committee. Stuart Ryan is my name. With me is Graham Scobie, who's a member of the House Movers section of the Heavy Haulage Association. I've circulated or been responsible, or perhaps irresponsible, for circulating a number of documents which have only occurred overnight.
Yes, we have those. I just wanted to note that the procedural minute that I sent out in January required that all written evidence be lodged in advance. And that a summary only be presented at the hearing so that it would be more efficient than Mr. Scobie's evidence.
I apologise for the delay that is my responsibility. I don't propose to have Mr. Scobie read his statement. It is a statement of the industry's position, and really, as a lay witness, Mr. Scobie's value in terms of assistance to the committee is as someone who has many decades of experience, and so really he's available to answer any questions that members may have.
So could we just take this? At the moment we'll take this evidence as table.
Yes, that's correct. Yes. And likewise, I've prepared some written submissions for the record, but I don't propose to read those verbatim at all.
That's fine. Thank you.
Thank you. So, for the record, what's been circulated is a single-page plan that I propose to speak to, a copy of a decision of the Environment Court called Central Otago District Council and Heavy Haulage Association, dating from 2004, some outline legal submissions, and the table statement of Mr. Scobie.
Yes.
The staff report is a well-written synopsis of the issues for the committee. There are several submissions on the issue. The position that's advanced for the association is to seek the outcome for Queenstown that was applied by the Environment Court in Central Otago in 2004. And if I can just, it may be that the association sort of belts and braces the submission of delete, replace, alternatives might have been a bit confusing, I said, for the officer, but the position advanced for the association is to seek permitted activity status for relocated buildings subject to a permitted activity regime that encompasses standards of the same kind that the Environment Court or Environment Court applied in the Central Otago decision. And that decision and extracts from it were referred to in the Association's original submission. In that case, the background was that under the former Tāmaka Country Planning Act, many plans regulated relocated buildings as an activity that required resource consent. I think conditional use often in many plans, and following the effects-driven approach of the RMA, that approach had been carried over into many first-generation plans, and the association and its members started to challenge that approach. And in Central Otago, the council there had a legacy of problems arising from old project houses from the dam building period. And there was a, if you like, a climate of regulation towards relocated buildings that had found their way into the district plan and really were a carryover from preceding plans. In terms of the operative Queenstown Lakes District Council plan, I think that was notified prior to the Central Otago decision. And so the association, so the association missed submitting on the generation one of the Queenstown Lakes District Plan, and therefore this is really the first opportunity for the association as an industry to submit on the issue of relocated buildings following that the Central Otago decision. Since that decision, most councils around the country have generally tended towards either not regulating relocated buildings so that they treat them simply as the same as in-situ constructed dwellings, or have adopted the Central Otago model of a permitted activity standard with, permitted activity classification with standards. And the court in Central Otago said, well, yes, there was an initial establishment period where the issue was appropriate reinstatement of the exterior of a dwelling to ensure that the dwelling wasn't an offence for local amenities. But that after that establishment period, the court found that there was no real material difference in RMA effect terms between a newly constructed in situ dwelling and a relocated dwelling, provided there had been appropriate reinstatement in terms of ensuring covering of the foundations, tying the building down to the foundations, installing baseboards, that's just kind of skirting around the foundations, any repair of damage to the building caused during the transportation process, in some cases painting or reinstatement of the exterior. And the court said, well, having toured in that case the township of Clyde, the court could pick in one or two cases where the relocated house was of different age or era from houses that were adjacent or adjoining to it, but the court didn't consider in its opinion that difference was an offence to local amenities in terms of amenity values, and therefore found in RMA terms that the proposed solution advanced by the Association of Permitted Activity Standards was an appropriate solution. The court there imposed a permitted activity standards requiring reinstatement within a 6-month period and requiring a pre-inspection report. So the standards imposed by the court in that case are attached. So that the standards imposed by the court in that case are set out at the end of that judgment and are basically adopted in the relief outcome sought by the association, and in the association's submission, I think in Schedule 1, there's a set of draft rules, and essentially those are repeated here.
There's a difference of reinstatement period of 12 months.
Yes, that's right.
The particular reason for that?
Yeah. In some areas in the country, the association has found that some exterior reinstatement is particularly not well suited to occurring over the winter months. So if the house is shifted at the start of winter, often people want to do painting over the summer months. So 12 might be perhaps you know, that's doubling what was imposed in Central Otago. An outcome of 9 months is acceptable to the association. So within, around the country, for the most part, the outcomes approved by the Environment Court in Central Otago have been adopted more or less with some tailoring to local conditions. The Central Otago decision approves the idea of a pre-inspection report occurring at the time of lodging a building consent, and that's an important issue because the choice, if you like, before the panel is whether to adopt the controlled activity approach plus conditions, which is recommended in the officer's report, or whether the association / Central Otago approach can ensure adequate reinstatement. That's the issue in terms of ensuring appropriate remediation. And
I have a question about the way the rules are drafted. I know the Environment Court have agreed to those rules, but in a practical sense, how do you prove something is a permitted activity when it requires the fulfilment of an obligation up to 9 months or 12 months into the future? It certainly couldn't get civil compliance for that.
Yeah, the way in which the proposed pre-inspection report is drafted is that it's in the form of a certificate. So it's crafted.
Well, it has a commitment.
Yes.
People enter those sort of commitments all the time.
Yes. Well, the form, and I've got copies available, provides for specified forms of mandatory reinstatement, and that reinstatement is assessed by someone who has appropriate qualifications. So it's a form of certificate that this work, be it connection to foundations or painting or something like that, is prescribed within a certain period. And the draft pre-inspection report specifies what that work is, the time frame for it to occur, and there's a form at the back of the pre-inspection form whereby the eventual owner of the building certifies that they're aware of those requirements and will comply with them. So the form's designed to meet the requirements of certainty in terms of being akin to a certificate. And the court, for its part, was satisfied that met reasonable standards of certainty in terms of being able to meet permitted activity criteria. I've got copies in colour of the pre-inspection form that's been circulated.
Yes, that would be.
Thank you. In preparing for the hearing, I was provided a copy of a form that's currently used by Queenstown Lakes District Council. I've got a very poor facsimile copy of it, but it's a two-page document. And the association has, with the assistance of the building surveyor, sought to basically expand upon the types of areas that require pre-inspection, and has been making its form freely available to local authorities as a non-statutory document. Of course, it's open for councils to prescribe a form as, say, a schedule or an appendix to the plan, or alternatively to specify an information rule which sets out the mandatory matters that a pre-inspection report must cover. So there's different ways of doing this. Either as a prescribed form, as an information rule which sets out what the form must cover, or as currently occurs and as occurred in Central Otago, where the form is effectively a non statutory form, but the rule sets out certain minimum requirements, and all of those approaches are acceptable to the submitter, so that whichever approach is adopted, there is sufficient certainty. Some councils prefer the approach of a non-statutory form, which allow them to tinker or amend the form as required to local circumstances. So the idea is that the form is prepared by someone who has a certain level of qualifications. The proposed rule in the drafting that's been circulated with discussion provides, I think, for a licensed building practitioner to complete the form. Some councils insist on people with certain degrees of qualification or building surveyors, and the availability of those sort of people very much depends on local conditions. In talking to Mr. Scobie before the hearing, some councils insist on pre-inspection forms being completed by council personnel themselves. That can be a problem where the building's being shifted a distance and officers then have to travel some way in order to inspect the building. But usually these issues are able to be resolved. But the objective is that there is some person who is sufficiently qualified, and a description of a licensed building practitioner is used in the draft rule, who completes the form, and it sets out the types of details that are to be completed, provides for a photographic survey of the building prior to relocation. It requires a certificate by the building surveyor that the building is safe and sanitary, and that's to meet at least the minimum requirements of the Building Act in terms of ensuring that the building is habitable. And again, that was a conditional stipulation that the Environment Court in Central Otago approved. And there's an estimate of cost provision. There's also a certificate by the surveyor that the building would have complied with the regulations at the time of its construction, bearing in mind that those regulations change or have changed. And there's also a onus declaration and certificate that states that the building will be completed within the prescribed period. The certificate goes on to acknowledge that the person acknowledges that failure to complete that work in the way that's prescribed may lead to council taking enforcement action under the RMA or under the Building Act. And so people can't be heard to grizzle if they don't do what they said that they've agreed to do, and council later finds that there is a problem. So the pre-inspection report is designed to be lodged at the time of application for building consent. So typically in a relocation, consent is required both to move the building, to shift it from its foundations end, to get consent tied to foundations at its end destination site. And Mr. Scobie tells me that councils are applying the Building Act locally so that if there is a particular wind loading or snow loading, that the building is effectively being required to be retrofitted to meet the environmental standards for the intended destination locality, which is a Building Act control would be applied under the Building Act provision. So that form is lodged at the time of building consent. And unlike a controlled activity consent, the proposed performance standards are certain insofar as they're available in the district plan. It lends itself readily to councils being able to prepare a very short sheet available for people as information that these are the rules that must be complied with in order to meet the standards for a relocated dwelling, because people have got to have some interaction with council before they relocate due to the requirements to obtain building consent prior to relocation. And if councils wish to adopt a form such as this or similar or tailor it to their circumstances, then that sort of information pack, if you like, is available to intended persons.
There's only one other area that I had a question about in your submissions, and I might as well cut straight to that.
Sure.
Is in paragraph, well, section 8, we're talking paragraph 8.2, that sound insulation rules not apply to relocating buildings. Is how would we deal with that when it's in the, within the out control boundary of the airports?
Look, I think I resolved from that submission. I don't think it's well founded. The association's case is that the same planning rules that apply to in situ constructed dwellings should apply to relocated dwellings.
So I think if they're inside the air control area, they have to put the ventilation system in and do the same insulation.
Yeah, yes. And I'm being out of town, I'm a bit unfamiliar with these particular acoustic rules, but I assume it's to do with the airport.
Yes, the Queensland Airport.
Yeah.
And it covers much of Frankton, the lower part of
it. Yeah. Yeah, so where the officer, I think, lands is that there shouldn't be a bespoke exemption. In other words, relocated buildings should comply with the same general standards that apply to newly constructed dwellings, whatever the local environmental conditions are. So if there's a local rule for landscape reasons that says that roofs should be moss green or light tussock or lichen coloured or whatever, then the same rule should apply to relocated dwellings. And
other than the controlled activity, that was the intention, as I read the officer's report.
Yes.
I should say that in the rural zone, all buildings, if they're permitted, have standards, exterior amenity value standards they have to meet to be permitted in any event. So we're really talking about the residential zones rather than the rural zones. This has been an issue, as I understand it.
Yes, well, we haven't sought to distinguish between zones, so if there's any particular zone rules that have a particular amenity, control, or characteristic, then the expectation would be that relocated dwellings would have to meet the same requirement. And so, Ruth, I think I can invite you to put a red pen through that sentence of my submission dealing with sound insulation, because I agree it's not well founded.
Yeah. questions.
Just one in regards to the Central Otago as an example where this has been placed for a while. Are you aware how well this is worked? How many?
Yeah.
Is it all done within 12 months or 9 months, 6 months, whatever? From there, how much does the council then have to go around chasing up people?
The association has, from time to time, had to persuade a few councils to follow the Central Otago approach, and so there have been half a dozen or so appeals since the Central Otago decision, but they've all been resolved. And generally, the trend has been from discretionary to controlled to, in some cases now, just no controls. There are problems that arise from time to time, and the association accepts that, like any industry, there can be some operators that don't play in accordance with reasonable standards. And so the approach that's advocated here today is not that there be no rules, rather that there be some rules, but permitted activity standards of a kind that were imposed in Central Otago. Some councils have gone further than that. Even when the association has sought rules, councils, and I can think of a couple, Rotorua and Tauranga, have just dispensed altogether with controls on relocated buildings so that they don't distinguish between in situ and relocates. In the Auckland example, there have been a few occasions in recent times where one or two relocateds have hit the press, and those have tended to be probably there's a large immigrant construction community who are just less familiar with RMA rules, particularly in the RMA in the Auckland context, and it seems in my view to be a feature of that. For the most part, I'm not aware of any council who, having gone the more liberal route, has sought to change back. In other words, council's been able to work through any issues, and as I say, the proposed pre-inspection report readily lends itself to sort of front-loading the issues so that people wanting to relocate have an information pack in advance, because they need building consent from council to kick off.
I was just wondering why Stratford on this map points out control activity.
Yeah. Someone forgot to make a submission. There's a couple of other oddities. I think Waimate is incorrectly represented. I think Waimate does is now permitted activity standard, so it's inaccurate there. But the grey shading, I think, mostly represents councils who had pre-Central Otago plans. There's a couple on the west coast. Marlborough's recently notified. I think Marlborough might have gone permitted. I'm not sure. But following Central Otago, most councils have adopted a more permissive approach.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ryan.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Scobie, for your attendance. And we will be subsequently
I perhaps should just mention that I do wonder sometimes whether this is a rule in search of a problem, because Mr. Scobie mentions to me that really most of the relocation in the district is dealt with. It might be relocation within the district, but the trend is generally movement out rather than movement into the district, just because of the nature of of the market here.
And I have to say, most of the suffering seems that I've seen go past me. Infrastructure problem is older than anyway.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, thanks for running.
It's actually quite a brief submission we've got here this morning, and I thought I'd just explain there's three different companies whose names the submission's in. Remarkable Park Limited, you'll know, is the developer of the Remarkable Park Town Centre. Queenstown Park Limited is the owner of the station that was formerly known as Cone Peak Station. So it lies on the true right bank of the Kawarau River and extends from the Confluence shop over down to Charles Park. And Queenstown Walls Limited is actually owned by three parties, Southern Discoveries, Real Journeys and Remarkable Park, and together they own St Omer Wharf and O'Regan's Wharf in town. So the parties consider, or the companies consider, that the references to public transport in this chapter should include water-based public transport and the provision of a gondola between the Remarkable Park Town Centre and the Remarkable Ski Field, to reduce reliance on private motor vehicle use. And look, can I suggest that we just go straight to the back page? I've given you an image here of the gondola alignment, and it might help put in context why we're saying this. So there's a red line going from the right-hand side of your page to the left-hand side of your page, from Remarkable Park Town Centre to Queenstown Park Mid Station, basically along the line that the Kawarau River flows. And you'll see that that line shows a residential transit station at Point G, which is immediately below or south of Lake Hayes Estate. Now, when we first were designing the gondola route, the line going down river actually had a bend just before it crossed the river the second time, and it went about 20 degrees, so it stayed entirely on the true right bank of the river. And at the time we were working on a pedestrian bridge across the Lake Hayes Estate to connect it to a station, but now we're working on a station on the Lake Hayes Estate side. So we always thought there'd be a connection, and this particular line is one of our favourite right from the start, but we're put off by the geotechs. Currently this month we're having geotechnical drilling done of that site. We've talked to council and the adjoining landowner about that, and with the intention that if we can, we'll build a station on that side. You can see the benefit would be that gondola cars are going in both directions, so that anyone from Lake Hayes Estate could be using that, or from Shotover Country or the new Frydale, to travel to Remarkables Park. The Remarkables Park Town Centre station is only 320 metres away from the new high school site. So immediately you've got some sort of connection there with school kids travelling to school. If you can imagine it, even if there's a large number of tourists in the morning, they're generally travelling down river and up the mountain, and all the cabins coming back are empty. The reverse happens in the afternoon, so there's a nice little connect there. So we can see it working for multiple people. We can also see it working for people connecting to the airport now, because on our property at Remarkable Park, people park there, as well as on the highways outside the airport, and walk to the airport when they're going away. And so this would be a nice little connection for Lake Hayes people. Equally, when you see the highway running across the bottom of the page, there's a lot of people that would be coming from Arrowtown and would possibly choose to connect to the gondola if they were using the gondola to access the ski field at Lake Hayes. So we envisaged something of a park and ride that could be used by two sets of people, and that would in turn would mean that there's a lot of traffic that doesn't actually have to travel through town over the shot over on the new bridge and up the ski field road. So we do see this as a genuine commuter option and something we'd like. And that just because this will come before you again, I should point out, if you look on the upper line, we've also changed slightly the upper line. Previously that had been a straight line, and now you'll see it's got a kink in it, and the station there called Queenstown Park Upper Station. That is required just in terms of the tow to make this gondola have the capacity that it requires. The line from the bottom to the top is 5 kilometres long. On this version it's actually about 5.2 metres long, and it ascends about 700 metres. So the motor is limited to carrying passengers at the rate of 1100 per hour on the original design. But by sticking another motor in at part way up the mountain, we can increase that to 2000 passengers an hour. So suddenly it becomes quite useful as a commuter gondola, as well as achieving the numbers up to the ski field. So if I can set that to the side,
so what they're saying is that it's actually a real principle benefit to the district.
I think
that's why this is the benefit of the ski field.
It's not just the ski field, it's other things too. And look, just while we're on there, I mean, one of the other aims we almost saw, but was that we envisage a trail on the Queenstown Park side of the station on the through right bank going down, which is the sunny side, and people would be able to make that as a bike connection down, well, gondola connection one way and a bike connection the other way. It's, so it has got some other real uses for the town.
Presumably from the halfway, the upper station as well.
Oh, for those who wish to do some crazy biking, yes, but not for me. Not the commuter. So I think Mr. Barr's concern was that the gondola doesn't exist, or there's not yet any provision for it in the district plan. Probably what we're saying there is one consideration is if you were to wait until after you've heard our submissions on Queenstown Park Station before you made a final decision on this part of the plan, then you might actually be able to reverse that. You might be able to say, yes, we want to make provision for a gondola, and therefore that can be included here as part of the utility section. And the point that I make at 1.3 is that whether or not it exists, I don't think you actually have to have the utility in existence before you make provision for it. And really I think that in most situations, with the utility, because it is a big investment item, it is quite smart to actually allow for it and then build it. I also make the point there that proposed gondola would provide a genuine commuter transport option, which we've just been discussing for people in Frankton and for example Lake Hayes. It would also provide a real transport alternative to use of the state highway, district roads and the ski field access road for those accessing the ski field and or the Rastersburn Recreation Reserve in summer. We also consider that the gondola and water-based transport are utilities that fall within the purpose of Chapter 30. They will be essential from a transportation perspective, bearing in mind the significant transport issues facing the district. Utilities are generally, but not always, provided by a network utility operator. They can be provided and maintained by private interests. The gondola in particular has high capital costs to establish and has specific locational needs. So just reference back to that plan again shows you the river line. We were also proposing, and you'll find when we come back with our submission on Queenstown Park Station, to have jet boat berths or ferry connections down the river at the Markles Park and at two other locations and one further down from this map that do provide a proper transport network back into onto the lake and into town. At 1.5 further, there's no doubt the water-based public transport and the provision of a gondola between the Remarkables Park Zone and the Remarkables Ski Field would deliver on policy 3.2.4.5, which states transport networks should be designed so that the number, length and need for vehicle trips is minimised and reliance on private motor vehicles is reduced to assist in reducing energy consumption. By adding the words alternative forms of transport such as water-based public transport and gondolas, it could form part of an integrated transport network or similar, the opportunity is properly recognised.
Just before you move on to the next section, But in terms of the policy, etc., of its sort, does it need to be specific to this route, or is it that gondolas provide transport potential?
I think it's possibly both. I think you're right, they do provide a transport potential, and I think if other parties wish to identify routes, that would be a useful thing to do. This is the temporary activity section. Basically, we're saying here that council is freeing up the rules for temporary activities on its own land, on public land, and we have no problem with that. I think that's a good idea. But we also think that because we're under the RMA, we should be looking at the site and the effects and the type of event, or the scale of the event, not at the ownership of the land. So we think that this could equally apply to land that private parties own. If I can give you one example, earlier this year we ran an event, we ran an open day through our land, which allowed people to bike down the Queensland Park Station, and at Chard Farm they ended up there with a sausage sizzle and coffee and a few things and a bit of a gathering. Now we had spots on the station where people could stop alongside the river, alongside some of the river flats, and some of them did end up swimming on the day, but it actually makes more sense to us to be able to accommodate something like that on our land too. You know, it could well be 500 people, because it was about 500 that went through on the bike day, and it seems quite sensible to be actually, without much hassle, be able to run that type of event. So I probably don't have to say much more about that, other than I see that Spellcheck has changed Craig's name to Banks, and not only that, seems to have changed his gender, so apologies to Mr. Barr.
Well,
no,
I think it was Ms. Banks who did that check.
And then the one on noise is basically a submission you've heard us make before. We're really saying that there are some of these general provisions that cover the district, but because the Remarkables Park Zone isn't included in this part of the district plan, they should not apply to Remarkables Park, and we're quite happy with the provisions we've got about noise, and we think they should be left alone. And I think you've heard us say that in
the trying to assist the council in resolving that problem.
Thank you.
I understand the complexity of it.
And you're right, and it does create complexities, because I noticed our lawyer's submission on the utility section actually said that should not apply to the Remarkables Park zone. So it sounds a bit odd for me to say utility should, for a gondola should extend from that zone into another zone, but I think we just asked for that to apply.
And that's one of the reasons why I asked if it was a general issue in the district. I mean, there's no reason why someone was so philanthropic they would have put their gondola from Wanaka to the Matawitupi Valley. That would be treated any differently. And if the Remarkables Park Zone is not part of this plan, then technically we can't deal with what is in with what that zone has, other than the fact that we know that there are activities there, such as the Remarkables Park Centre and the high school.
Yes. We think there's no limits or no restrictions on Remarkables Park building the gondola within the Remarkables Park zone. None of the structures exceed the height limit, I think, right up to about 12 metres.
It's just going to get to the river.
Exactly, it's at the river. And what we're proposing and what we'll show you later is that we've now shown a corridor for the gondola running down, and I suppose we've been asking you to include that corridor that's outside the Remarkables Park zone in the district there.
We'll get to the map.
One question, Russ, is Burnham Recreation Reserve, is that to the height of the uphill gondola line?
No, it's actually the name that the Department of Conservation gives to the whole ski field zone. So it's probably just that it's the same area. So where you look at the top of the gondola line, the gondola line ends exactly right inside the new base building that the NZ Ski's built. That's about dead centre of the Rasmusburn Recreation Zone. So the Recreation Zone includes Lake Alta, whereas the ski area sub-zone doesn't go that far.
Okay.
So it's a slightly bigger area. It's entirely recreation reserve and not conservation land.
Thank you. Would the upper station be within QPL's land?
Yes, it is. That's almost its boundary. We're actually trying to push it as high as we can. If we go a little further south than that, we would be coming into docks land and just the start of that recreation zone. It's, so we've gone within about 40 metres of it.
Oh, that's quite handy to understand how far.
Yes, indeed. So it's about 100 metres below the road and 40 metres to the fence line if you're ever looking up there.
This was an option to take the gondola into Queenstown, isn't it?
Within my head there is, alright. But I don't want to look at the thing if I think it's not. I think that's a commendable idea, but it needs some real working through.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Just briefly at my paragraph 3, Spark, Vodafone and Chorus all lodged identical submissions and are presenting this as a joint presentation as a single voice of the industry. Moving on to paragraph 4, I've listened to the audio and questions asked of Mr. Barr on day 1 of the hearing and read his supporting statement, summary statement of evidence. Note that Mr. Barr has agreed with these suggested modifications to Rule 20.4.14 pertaining to telecommunication and radio masts, and the modification to Rule 30.4.19 to rationalise the controls for antennas.
these are important provisions for the telecommunications industry. The officer's support for the change of sort is welcome, and on that basis we won't be labouring those subjects today. Turning to objectives and policies, in my opinion, the objective of policy limits recommended by Mr. Barr shows a more appropriate balance between enabling and protection compared to the notified version of the proposed plan. In light of the regional policy statement, the proposed regional policy statement, and Council's revised positions with respect to the strategic directions chapter. In particular, I note and support the recommended changes to objectives 30.2.5 and 30.2.6 and policies 30.2.5.1 and 30.2.5.2. Further amendments continue to be sought to objective 30.2.7 and policy 30.2.7.1 to recognise that it is not always possible to fully avoid, remedy or mitigate adverse events within the very large outstanding natural landscape areas in the district. As the outstanding natural landscapes identified in the proposed plan cover a range of existing modified environments, in my opinion, it is important that the objective and policy mix does not assume that some further development of infrastructure is inappropriate. On the rules for lines, it is positive that Mr. Barr's recommendation specifically addressed the gap in the notified version of the plan that did not provide for underground lines as permitted activities, and includes improvements to the definition of minor upgrading, including a committed activity status, both of which in my opinion are appropriate and are low risk in terms of resulting in more than minor adverse environmental effects. Small cell, the evidence of Mr. McCarrison and Mr. Clune outlines the changing nature of telecommunication infrastructure and particularly identifies the move towards small cells, which are not clearly provided for in the energy and utilities chapter. And I suggest today a committed activity framework for those facilities up to a small volume, and that is consistent with the underdevelopment national environmental standard for telecommunications facilities, and a control activity status is suggested for a larger volume with the default discretionary above that. I have, in respect to drafting issues, I saw a number of changes to the drafting of certain provisions throughout the proposed plan, which, in my opinion, if left unchecked, could have unintended consequences. These include uncertain references to building throughout the energy and utilities chapter, so rules, obscure matters of control, conflicting rules, and some rules with multiple activity status that could conflict. And we would welcome an opportunity to further work through those issues with council officers. In conclusion, overall it is my opinion that the suggested amendments, along with the proposed amendments from Mr. Barr and further directions given by the hearing panel in relation to this chapter, will strike a better balance between protection of the environment from adverse effects and enabling the benefits of network utilities to the social and economic well-being of the community.
So I've just got a couple of questions on your brief of evidence. On page 4, in paragraph 13, you refer to the regional policy statement. Are you referring to the opposite or the proposed
bill? The opposite bill in paragraph 13.
Okay. In the following paragraph, you say the submissions from the telecommunication companies sought to redress this balance. Are you suggesting that section 6 matters and 6 of landscape matters in this district need to be balanced with social and economic well-being?
Not specifically in terms of balance within the balancing, I think is a terminology, I think, that you would certainly call pre-canned salmon. I don't think it's the appropriate approach to take. I was meaning in terms of the
balance in more of a colloquial term, in terms of the objective and policy mix of the proposed plan.
Across on page 6 in paragraph 20, you say that, and you've repeated this in the summary, that it's not always possible to fully avoid, remedy, or mitigate adverse effects. Surely it's possible to do some of those. Mitigate is a pretty broad concept, isn't it?
Yes, and I think there's two aspects to this. One is that these outstanding landscape areas cover a range of pre-existing built activities and environments. So in my view, there is some potential for further development, particularly within those areas. And in terms of avoiding, remedy, or mitigating the effects of telecommunication facilities, you've got a range of evidence that identifies that, certainly in terms of radio communication facilities, there's a need for line of sight, as it were, in terms of these things need to be above the obstructions, therefore they are.
I should advise I know this because I use a Wi-Fi line of sight.
Yes, precisely, and some aspects of them may be able to be, the effects may be able to be mitigated through location and colouring and things, but essentially there are operational requirements that if the communities to be provided with coverage.
So you did say they can be mitigated with colouring and things.
Exactly.
That's what I'm wondering, if there is always that some mitigation.
There is some mitigation, but
isn't location in some ways can be mitigation too, even when they have to be in particular locations. Those locations are never down to a precise half metre or so.
Yes, and I think there are some good photographs in the Section 42A report that identified some sites which, in my view, had the effects avoided or mitigated down to a pretty good level on that. So, but it's not a matter of total avoidance or total. You can't have a sort of zero effect, as it were. Really, it is the overall reference in 30.3.1. The implication of that rule is that if there are rules somewhere else in the plan that are not met, then a resource consent will be required. And that may be presumably about building height limits or setbacks from boundaries and things like that.
Unless specifically stated to the contrary, is that what you're referring to?
That is in the 30.3.3.3. And yes, that's that is the telecommunications company's preference in terms of William. But if in these other parts there is other William, that could imply that all of the other district plan rules apply.
Okay, so you just want, what you're really saying is you want us to make sure that there's, that it's clear
clarity.
The intention is clear, so I understand Christian not to the other day, but the intention is to be a distinction.
That's great.
This is in relation to paragraph 14 of the objectives and policies, and then the part that you were also in regard to 23 in regard to the outstanding natural landscapes and how utilities fit within that. I'm trying to understand in terms of the rules that you've amended and attached to the back of your evidence, how is that translated through to the rules in terms of what activity status and for what activities, particularly in O&Ls, have you addressed? So how have you taken what you had in the objectives policies and then translated that into the rules?
In the rule framework that I have suggested, it would enable a development activity, small scale, telecommunication infrastructure in outstanding natural landscapes, and that is more or less consistent with what is in the existing operative district plan. It also provides for the addition of antennas, etc., to existing sites within outstanding natural landscapes as a permitted activity. Those are the key changes.
And what is it that you mean by small scale?
Just pop it open, I think, is a height limit suggested at 8 metres. There is colouring requirements.
Thirty-four fourteen.
Yes. That's correct, you said.
In terms of the rules and the definition of telecommunications facilities, we're trying to work out which, because it deleted facilities out of the beginning part of that rule. How is the rule limited to small scale?
Yes, sir, that rule was just in relation, as I have changed it, to be masts.
Right.
I did listen to your day one questioning on that issue of the council officers, and that reference to facilities would open that rule be very broad.
Mm-hmm.
And in my opinion, this rule is actually about masks, and that's what I changed to the beginning.
So, we're doing telecommunications facilities now sit within the rule frame that is even better.
In the, if you go over the page effectively to 30.4.17, I've done a more general structures associated to, ancillaries that are associated with utilities in place of the building structure, so effectively this provides for cabinets and other limited scale buildings and such. There are rules for masts and there are rules for lines that are separate as well. So effectively, instead of having an all-encompassing facilities type ruling, it's broken down more into constituent parts and different kinds of utilities.
The other thing that I noted was that the telecommunication facility definition in the plan is very different to that which is in the National Environmental Standard, both the current one and the existing one, proposed one rather, the proposed and the existing one. My concern is that when this definition of facility and the way the rules, not necessarily as you've written them, but as the officers have done, prepared it, that it means that what's a telecommunication facility, as we said before, is very wide, and therefore, because it includes equipment, buildings, so if you've got a building in there, you don't need the rules regarding buildings at all.
I think the source of that definition, I suspect, is the Telecommunications Act, just through reading it. So there are some, I agree, certainly some inconsistencies within Telecommunications National Environmental Standard Act's proposal. Harrison, I think we did speak to you on that.
I've
been involved on those. However, I think the way that I've made adjustments to the chapter in my track changes version resolves the issue that we're concerned about. No longer has rules around that broad telecommunications facility.
Right. Frank Harrison and I have talked about this before, and what's a facility and what's a network, and what I want to understand is that does it mean the same thing that you're saying that the intent of your evidence is line, masts, buildings, and that's what separates it out. It would then seem to me that it's still telecommunication facility would need some work in terms of being, wasn't section 44A, need to look at that and how it, that applies to it, given a standard that's already existing.
You said, given the adjustments to the rules, I'm not even sure that that exists. Well, my proposed adjustments to the rules, I'm not entirely sure that that exact term will be used further, so that might be a consequential need for adjustment.
Because I've been here for other hearings and that I've been told to refer to WESI 180099, so this is decision of the environment called on the last district plan here. And in this, in particular, I'm going to give this to the officer to be able to look at it. It's in regard to sizing of utilities and outstanding natural landscapes in this district, and that it should not be as of right a policy that states sizing where practical utilities away from skylines always leaves the door open for the utility operator to argue that it is not practical to site a utility anywhere else. That is not the right approach. The policy should be one that gives council the final say on locations with an outstanding natural landscape. That's a legal point, but I'd be interested in your view on how that might apply. It's highlighted on the
just going to tell the fact if you'd like more time to consider that. We'll be adjourning at 11:30 for morning tea. If you want to answer that question after a chance to do that decision, we'll carefully on
that. I would appreciate that opportunity. Thank you very much.
That's a very important decision to understand rather than just seeing those lines.
So thank you.
Just 1 week, which was new evidence, which is point 23, which is page 6, when as the ONL identified the proposed plan to cover a range of existing modified environments, in my opinion, it's important that the objection policy makes does not assume that some further development of infrastructure is inappropriate. Surely that should also be appropriate. So it applies equally to both.
Yes, I'm really just trying to point out that the ONLs cover roads and all sorts of things like that where utilities are normally expected. I agree that there are certainly some parts of the district that utilities are, I would agree that the utility is likely to be inappropriate at almost any scale. But there's not that refinement within the ONLs.
That's very limited comment.
Yes. You have a brief statement in front of you, a joint statement of Mr. Harrison's claim, including a summary that's been provided to you. There is also the question of the technical material in terms of the PowerPoint. However, given that the council officer is largely in agreement with respect to the height issues that we are currently seeking, and a large amount of that information is about height, you can be given a summary of that presentation if you would like, or that can be just held on a record as a written document, and then we could move directly to just Mr. McHarrison's point.
We'll just take that as a record. But easily understand. Well, I've got on my iPad, I can easily understand the plot, the fact that some of that those are presentations.
If you have any questions from that, those two witnesses are available to answer your questions.
Straws and so forth. And,
we did have one.
Yes,
we did have one presentation where we had four people and they did a sentence each that went back and forth. It was interesting to keep track of.
Yeah. So I suppose Colin and me have drawn on our experience as
part of the technical advisory group for the National Environmental Service. Plus also, Colin's quite experienced with doing a fair bit of consent work in this district. I tend to operate more at the sort of policy level across the country, and you'll be aware that the telecommunications companies, we work pretty closely together and regularly just do joint submissions in each company's name, but actually front up like this to give an industry perspective on what we're doing. It seems that the key points out of our evidence basically related to the NES and where that was headed to. And you will have seen that the basic reason for updating it, it was 2008, 5 years has sort of run its course, it needed to be updated. And so this is the first review of a real formal review of an NES, and that's come with some interesting process stuff, but and we're now in the final stages. In fact, yesterday we provided a legal review on the exposure draft, final exposure draft back to government, basically. And with the government's intent to have the NES in place roughly at the end of November, early December, at the latest. And so it's in its final couple of weeks before going back to Cabinet, basically in the middle of October is what we understand at this stage. And the summary document that was appended, and Mr. Farr had already included in the pack, basically the content is reasonably in place and similar to what was in that summary submission. And so what it leaves, or what it puts on the NES, is the opportunity for telecommunication lines. And to be fair, while of course it's out here, you've got a new fibre network that's been completely built out, we're headed into
and
we're going into the bid stages for UFB2 RBI, which is rural broadband, and black spot funding, basically now, to which the NES becomes a really critical tool for lines in particular, so above ground, aerial, and basically for service connections, a above ground but not aerial, so sitting on the ground or attached to other structures, connecting from the road connection through someone's property. It's not that common, but that those three options have been provided as permitted, and permitted through an O&L any place basically within New Zealand to do that, to enable the rollout of principally fibre to as many places as possible in the next stages, with the outcome trying to hit roughly 97% of New Zealand with good digital connection. So that's quite a significant national change, and is the only part of the NES that the district plans are not deferred to for O&L heritage, that sort of activities. Then for the rest of the NES relates principally to the mobile network that we principally represent, but we also do build a lot of fibre and so forth and amongst the various companies. So when they took over Telstra Clear Network, put a very large copper and fibre network, Spark has its own fibre and building a lot of fibre network as well to service our cell sites, all of our cell sites, both companies and 2 Degrees as well.
rely on fibre and so forth. So it's a mixture of using Chorus's fibre and then our own as well. So it's important to all of us. So the two new provisions for cell sites, classes basically, is one in the roads, and so basically taking the current light pole type solution, so you replace the light pole, replace it with a mobile site on it, takes that away with a slimline pole, similar height by the time you calculate it, it's an average of the neighbouring poles, and so basically it's designed to be next to another pole, so if it couldn't be in a rural area where there was no poles in the road, and in this district a lot of the power network is in private property, so you wouldn't be able to use those poles even if they were 100 metres away from the road. So we don't believe it's going to lead to poles in rural areas, but it's designed to be a pretty much an urban solution here in the district. And that's a visual unity. The other one is new bus in rural areas, so a rural zone piece of land, so principally zones that are termed rural or have similar enough description and cover rural activities, so rural residential, that sort of thing.
Does it include rural
residential?
Yes, it does.
What
about rural lifestyle?
That would fit within that as well.
Gives it some special character area?
I haven't actually thought about that one. It would come back to the description of and purpose of that area, and if it was more about the protection of the amenity rather than rural production, then I think it would sit within the special amenity type feature provisions. You guys would defer to district plans. It's always going to be one of those debate things as we implement it.
So SNAs?
They would defer to the district plan rules.
What about RNLs?
Significant features. Within the New Zealand profession, we've called them different things around the country. Auckland's introduced a whole lot of new overlays that mixed it up a bit as well. We've termed all of those would fit into that, and one of the original terms was just general visual amenity. That's been more termed to natural landscape features, sort of the term for it. So it's not a O&L, but it's that lower level but significant areas. So
what here in the operative thing is called a visual amenity area.
Yes. Yep. And in Christchurch and some of those other areas, you've got ridgeline protection, Auckland's got view shafts, these sort of things. So the key local areas, usually reasonably geographically defined, but haven't been termed an O&L. So it's quite inclusive. The rule set for those special areas where the district plan should prevail over the NS, basically, which is a sensible approach to things. The other key to new things is the introduction of the small cell, which is a small integrated unit. There's a picture, a general picture there. John will be able to correct me. So they're not generally in use. They kind of use them in, John,
they use them in buildings usually for delaying their macro network from high capacity users. So people these days tend to use these things a lot for a lot of data carry. But we try to protect our macro network by implementing the small cell solutions. There's also some smaller cell solutions for urban areas like CBDs and areas like that where we can attach a smaller antenna to a mast which will provide very spot coverage that doesn't provide wide area coverage. That deals with a bit of usage.
Because that's what's termed an urban cell in the appendix.
Yes, yeah, but this bottom picture here. Basically, so it's a small box basically that's designed to attach to structures. And the only thing that would normally protrude out of it would be fiber cabling, basically. So then little antennas internal to it and all the other workings of it. So they're quite small in size, so that's 0.11 of a cubic metre. And so they're basically being recognised, would generally be expected to go anywhere. Septum, those O&L and so forth, I would still defer to a district plan to say what is appropriate there. The other provisions is the upgrading of existing sites within the road and other consented or established cell sites, with the potential for those to be increased by a height of 3.5 metres where it's got a single provider on it, in 5 metres where it's got more than one provider on it, with the aim to encourage more co-location of facilities, basically. And they're really the sort of key things. There's one other rule that the government indicated would come in as well, and that's to make the recognise that telecommunications networks operate like electricity through existing natural hazard areas. So in floodplains, earthquakes, fault lines, can't avoid them in New Zealand. And so that's been recognised as a permitted activity as well. Principally, it's a lack of choice of having to go where you basically need to go.
Just on the proposed areas, am I right in assuming that when that is declared in the years, effectively what is in it has to be included in this plan under the Act?
Yes.
So, the council won't be making decisions on these hearings before November.
No.
They may not be making them before November 2017. So we certainly will be able to incorporate them once they're promulgated and gazetted. Thank you for the advance warning.
We've been trying to sort of work with this for a while, and it's that weird situation to be in with having very detailed knowledge of where it's headed to, but only been able to talk in the general terms and so trying to create submissions that enable that opportunity to happen as easily as possible. Thank you.
In terms of the new definition of telecommunication facility, it includes aerial or underground cables.
Yep.
And then telecommunication cables separately defined in regard to line or part of line. So when this talks about the telecommunication facility, what does it cover in terms of what facility means in this context?
Yeah. So the terminology when it was created was to recognise at the higher level the concept of a facility, and that a facility included basically anything. And one of the changes that I think will go through is that it makes it quite clear that it includes lines as well, but it also
cable and line.
So we're going to use the term line basically to put a distinction between electricity and vice versa. but there will also be the definition of a telecommunication line as well, and then obviously within the structure of the NS some rules or standards for telecommunication lines exactly, but everywhere through it everything's called a facility. So it's one of those legal drafting things that is annoying, where what we've tried to do in our district plan submissions is break everything into its component parts, basically.
Yeah, I mean, there's a different definition of the mast,
which
is exactly what the component parts done.
Yep.
The mast isn't a facility, is that?
A facility is about the thing that actually makes it work. The mast, I think, in this term of facility, how it's been, how the NS is structured, excludes a pole, interestingly. So we're going from calling mast to poles, which is painful because that really is an electricity thing. But, you know, can't influence the parliamentary legal drafters too much, so they like the word pole in their minds, and their opinion is that the structure that the devices that are communicating, so transmitting, so an antenna, the cabinet itself, which has got other equipment in it to make it operate, form and the cable to connect it all together, and small cell because it's basically an integrated antenna. That is the facility. The pole is the thing that you just attach.
That's just what
depends on it. Yeah.
Yes.
And so they kind of separated it like that, and which is a little, and so then you have the rules around, well, what is a pole, how high it can be, as you know, in a district plan. But it's quite a different structure to what we use to structure in our district plans, basically. And to be fair, our road testing with local government and ourselves, it was the one thing that everyone said, this is just really difficult to understand. So hopefully we've simplified it a bit in the last few days, but it's still going to be structured like that. So
the reason for this question is, it just seems that as two telecommunication facilities identified, defined in the plan, it's much wider than that, and then there's a whole lot of consequences from that that I'm trying to understand. Is it the telecommunications company's position that it prefers the version of the district plan, or does it prefer the one in the NES, only because the equipment buildings and that will be, I'm assuming that includes all telephone exchanges as well, therefore they're all, that will potentially be permitted activities and things like that, and try and understand what's the telecommunications company's position, so we can
understand
that. Or do these things
get
rid of telephone exchanges?
Exactly. within the industry, we're moving into very small structures, and so what you would normally see, like the exchange here, centre of town, is a much bigger building than what you would build now. You probably just never build something like that. So because of the digitisation of it, we're basically having exchanges that look more like a bank of computers. And as the technology changes, we're also closing down some of those smaller exchanges because we don't need them, but with copper network needing to keep running until last person at the moment basically comes off it, then those structures will be in place for a lot longer. But if you take the Chorus cabinets themselves, they're just close to being mini exchanges, generally underground now, which is just the connection of fibre from one place to the other, so you're transferring digital signal. and that's essentially what we do now. So our facilities are really small. In a number of district plans, we've even asked for those to be permitted in the unitary plan. The exchange is actually a facility that's a permitted activity to build those sorts of things. However, I don't think anyone's proposing to actually build them. If anything, we're going back to a Whitehaven comment.
No, we are pulling back from exchanges.
Yeah.
We just turned the first one off in Nightcaps last week.
And so then that led to a nice little photograph of a bank of computers that was sitting like this in the Dunedin Exchange. And well, that was that exchange now. There it is. And there's a bit more resilient.
Okay. I'm not sure if you've actually answered my question.
No.
What I want to know is, is it still that very wide definition of the facilities you're seeking? Or is it something else?
When we come back after the break, just like to talk about, because basically where we've got to with the rule set is that definition is irrelevant. But in terms of the policy framework and stuff, have a think about that. But then basically it's pretty irrelevant.
And there'll be a definition.
Yeah, exactly. Generally, I would just say that there's a national definition, so either refer to it or just not have anything.
Okay, we'll give you a chance.
Thank you.
We'll adjourn until the 11:15.